The yellow SE-5A bored up powerfully into the soft grey belly of the sky. Michael chose one of the gaps in the lower layer of cloud, roared swiftly through it, and burst out into the open corridor. High above, there was still the same high roof of solid cloud, but below it the air was limpid as crystal. When his altimeter registered 8,000 feet, Michael levelled out. He was in the clear, equidistant from the layers of cloud above and below him, but through the gaps he could pick up his landmarks. The villages of Cantan and Aubigny-au-Bac were deserted, shell-shattered skeletons. Only a few stone chimney pieces had survived the waves of war, which had washed back and forth over them. These stuck up like funeral monuments from the muddy, torn earth. The two villages were 4 miles apart. The road that once joined them had been obliterated, and the front lines twisted like a pair of maimed adders through the brown fields between them. The shell holes filled with stagnant water blinked up at him like the eyes of the blind. Michael glanced at his watch. It was 4 minutes to 4 o'clock, and his eyes immediately returned to their endless search of the empty sky. One at a time, he lifted his hands from the controls and flexed his fingers, at the same time wriggling his toes in the kudu skin boots, loosening up like a runner before the pistol. He reached up to the firing handle with both hands to test the trim of the machine, and she flew on straight and level. He fired both his guns, a short burst from each of them, and he nodded and blew on the gloved fingers of his right hand. "I need a drink," he told himself, and took Andrew's silver flask from his pocket. He took a mouthful and gargled it softly, and then swallowed. The fire of it bloomed in his bloodstream, but he resisted the temptation to drink again. He stoppered the flask and dropped it back into his pocket. He touched the left rudder to begin his turn into the square patrol pattern, and at that moment he picked up the flea-black speck on the grey mattress of the clouds far ahead, and he met the turn, holding her steady while he blinked his eyes rapidly and checked his sighting. The other machine was at 8,000 feet, exactly his own height, and it was closing swiftly, coming in from the north, from the direction of Douai, and he felt the spurt of adrenaline mingle with the alcohol in his blood. His cheeks burned and his gut spasmed. He eased the throttle open and flew on to meet it. The combined speeds of the two aircraft hurled them together so that the other machine swelled miraculously in front of Michael's eyes. He saw the bright blue of the nose and propeller boss hazed by the spinning blades and the wide Black Hawk's wings outstretched. He saw the helmeted top of the pilot's head between the two black Spandau machine guns mounted on the engine cowling, and the flash of his goggles as he leaned forward to peer into his sights. Michael pushed the throttle fully open, and the engine bellowed. His left hand held the joystick like an artist holding his brush, with the lightest pressure of his fingertips, as he positioned the German exactly in the centre of the concentric rings of his own gun sight, and his right hand reached up for the firing handle. His hatred and his anger grew as swiftly as the image of his enemy, and he held his fire. The battle clock in his head started to run, so that the passage of time slowed. He saw the muzzles of the Spandau machine gun begin to wink at him, bright sparks of fire, flickering red as the planet Mars on a moonless night. He aimed for the head of the other pilot, and he pressed down on the trigger and felt the aircraft pulse about him as his guns shook and rattled. No thought of breaking out of that head-on charge even occurred to Michael. He was completely absorbed by his aim, trying to stream his bullets into the German's face to rip out his eyes and blow his brains out of the casket of his skull. He felt the Spandau bullets plucking and tugging at the fabric and frame of his machine, heard them passing his head with sharp, flitting sounds like wild locusts, and he ignored them. He saw his own bullets kicking white splinters off the German's spinning propeller, and in anger knew that they were being deflected from his true aim. The two aircraft were almost in collision, and Michael braced himself for the impact without lifting his hand from the firing handle, without attempting to turn. Then the Albatross winged up violently, at the very last instant avoiding the collision, flicking out to starboard as the German hurled her over. There was a jarring bang that shook the SE-5A. The two wings had just brushed each other as they passed. Michael saw the torn strip of fabric trailing from his own wingtip. He kicked on full rudder, into that flat skidding turn that only the SE-5A was capable of, and felt the wings flex at the strain, and then he was around. The Albatross was ahead of him, but still out of effective range. Michael thrust with all his strength on the throttle handle, but it was already wide open, the engine straining at full power, and still the Albatross was holding him off. The German turned and went up left, and Michael followed him. They climbed more steeply, going up almost into the vertical, and the speed of both machines began to bleed off, but the SE-5A more rapidly, so that the German was pulling ahead. "It's not the same Albatross," Michael realized with a shock, that the relocation of the radiator was not the only modification. He was fighting a new type of aircraft, an advanced type, faster and more powerful than even his own SE-5A. He saw the wide sweep of those black and white checkered wings and the head of the German pilot craning to watch him in his mirror, and he tried to bring his guns to bear, swinging his ring sight in a short arc as he wrenched his nose across. The German flipped his Albatross into a stall turn and came straight back at Michael, head on again, with the Spandaus flicking their little red eyes at him, and this time Michael was forced to brake, for the German had height and speed. For a crucial moment, Michael was hanging in his turn. His speed had dwindled and the German rounded on him and dropped on to his tail. The German was good. Michael's guts tightened as he realized it. He pushed his nose down for speed and at the same time flung the SE-5A into a vertical turn. The Albatross followed him round, turning with him, so that they were revolving around each other, like two planets caught in immutable orbits. He looked across at the other pilot, lifting his chin to do so, for each of them was standing on one wingtip. The German stared back at him, the goggles making him appear monstrous and inhuman, and then, for an instant, Michael looked beyond the bright blue fuselage, up towards the high cloud ceiling, his hunter's eyes drawn by a tiny insect speckle of movement. For an instant, his heart ceased to pump, and his blood seemed to thicken and slow in his veins. Then, with a leap like a startled animal, his heart raced away, and his breathing hissed in his throat. "I have the honor to inform you, and at the same time also to warn you," the German had written. "The object of warfare is the destruction of the enemy by all means possible." Michael had read the warning, but only now did he understand. They had turned his woolly-headed romantic notion of a single duel into a death trap. Like a child, he had placed himself in their power. He had given them time and place, even the altitude. They had used the blue machine merely as a decoy. His own naivety amazed him now, as he saw them come swarming down out of the high cloud. How many of them? There was no time to count them, but it looked like a full jester of the new type albatrosses, 20 of them at least, in that swift and silent flock, their brilliant colours sparkling jewel-like against the sombre backdrop of cloud. "I'm not going to be able to keep my promise to Santin," he thought, and looked down. The low cloud was 2,000 feet below him. It was a remote haven, but there was no other. He could not hope to fight 20 of Germany's most skilled aces. He would not last for more than a few seconds when they reached him, and they were coming fast, while the blue machine pinned and held him for the killing stroke. Suddenly, faced with the death which he had deliberately sought, Michael wanted to live. He had been dragging back on the joystick with all his weight, holding the SE-5A into its turn. He flicked the stick forward, and she was flung outwards, like a stone from a slingshot. Michael was hurled up against his shoulder straps as the forces of gravity were inverted, but he collected the big machine and used its own impetus to push it into a steep dive, going down with a gut-swooping rush towards the low cloud bank. The manoeuvre caught his opponent off balance, but he recovered instantly, and the albatross was after him in a blue flash of speed, while the swarming multicoloured pack was overhauling them both from above. Michael watched them in the mirror above his head, realising how much quicker this new type of albatross was in the dive. He glanced ahead to the clouds. Their grey folds, which had seemed so clammy and uninviting a few seconds before, were his only hope of life and salvation. And now that he had started to flee, his terror came back and settled upon him like a dark and terrible succubus, draining him of his courage and manhood. He wasn't going to make it. They would catch him before he reached cover, and he clung to the joystick, frozen with his new and crippling terror. The clatter of twin Spandaus roused him. In the mirror, he saw the dancing red muzzle of flashes, so close behind him, and something hit him a numbing blow low down in his back. The force of it drove the air from his lungs, and he knew he must turn out of the killing line of the blue albatross's guns. He hit the rudder bar with all his force, attempting the flat skidding turn that would bring him face to face with his tormentors, but his speed was too great, the angle of dive too steep. The SE-5A would not respond. He lurched and yawed into a turn that brought him broadside on to the pursuing pack, and although the blue albatross overshot, the others fell upon him one after the other, each successive attack a split second after the last. The sky was filled with flashing wings and bright-coloured fuselages. The crash of shot into his aircraft was continuous and unbearable. The SE-5A dropped a wing and went into a spin. Sky and cloud and patches of earth, interspersed with bright-coloured albatrosses with flickering, chattering guns, spun through Michael's field of vision in dizzying array. He felt another blow, this time in his leg, just below the fork of his crotch. He looked down and saw that a burst had come up through the floor, and a bullet, misshapen and deformed, had ripped through his thigh. Blood pumped from it in bright arterial jets. He had seen a Zulu gun-bearer savaged by a wounded buffalo bleed this way from a ruptured femoral artery. He had died in 3 minutes. Streams of machine-gun fire were still coming in at him from every angle, and he could not defend himself, for his aircraft was out of control, flicking through the turns of the spin, throwing her nose up viciously, and then dropping it again in that savage rhythm. Michael fought her, thrusting on opposite rudder, trying to break the pattern of her rotation, and at the exertion the blood pumped more strongly from his torn thigh, and he felt the first giddy weakness in his head. He dropped one hand from the joystick and thrust his thumb into his own groin, seeking the pressure point, and the great pulsing red spurt shriveled as he found it. Again he coaxed the maimed aircraft stick forward to stop that high nose altitude and a burst of throttle to power her out of the spin. She responded reluctantly, and he tried not to think about the machine-gun fire that tore at him from every side. The clouds and earth stopped revolving about him as her tight turns slowed and she dropped straight. Then, with one hand only, he pulled her nose up and felt the overstressing of the wings and the suck of gravity in his belly. But at last the world tilted before his eyes as she came back on to an even keel. He glanced in the mirror and saw that the blue albatross had found him again and was pressing in close on his tailplane for the coup de grâce. Before that dreadful, rattling chatter of the Spandau could begin again, Michael felt the cold, damp rush across his face as grey streamers of cloud blew over the open cockpit. And then the light was blotted out, and he was into a dim, blind world, a quiet, muted world where the Spandaus could no longer desecrate the silences of the sky. They could not find him in the clouds. Automatically, his eyes fastened on the tiny, glycerin-filled glass tubes set on the dashboard in front of him, and with small, controlled adjustments, he aligned the bubbles in the tubes within their markers so that the SE-5A was flying straight and level through the cloud. Then he turned her gently onto a compass heading for Mortom. He wanted to be sick. That was his first reaction from terror and the stress of combat. He swallowed and panted to control it, and then he felt the weakness come at him again. It was as though a bat was trapped in his skull. The dark, soft wings beat behind his eyes, and his vision faded in patches. He blinked away the darkness and looked down. His thumb was still thrust into his own groin, but he had never seen so much blood. His hand was coated, his fingers sticky with it. The sleeve of his jacket was soaked to the elbow. Blood had turned his breeches into a sodden mass, and it had run down into his boots. There were pools of blood on the floor of the cockpit, already congealing into lumps like blackcurrant jam, and snakes of it slithering back and forth with each movement of the machine. He let go of the stick for a moment, leaned forward against his shoulder straps, and groped behind his back. He found the other bullet wound, 3 inches to the side of the spine, and just above the girdle of his pelvis. There was no exit wound. It was still in there, and he was bleeding internally, he was certain of it. There was a swollen, stretched feeling in his belly as his stomach cavity filled with blood. The machine dropped a wing, and he snatched for the joystick to level her, but it took him many seconds to make the simple adjustment. His fingers prickled with pins and needles, and he felt very cold. His reactions were slowing down, so that each movement, no matter how small, was becoming an effort. However, there was no pain, just a numbness that spread down from the small of his back to his knees. He removed his thumb to test the wound in his thigh, and immediately there was a full spray of bright blood from it, like a flamingo's feather, and hastily he stopped it again and concentrated on his flying instruments. How long to reach Mortom? He tried to work it out, but his brain was slow and muzzy. 9 minutes from Quentin, he reckoned. How long had he been flying? He did not know, and he rolled his wrists so that he could see his watch. He found he had to count the divisions on the dial like a child. Don't want to come out of the cloud too soon. They'll be waiting for me. He thought it heavily, and the dial of his wristwatch multiplied before his eyes. Double vision, he realized. Quickly he looked ahead, and the silver clouds billowed around him, and he had the sensation of falling. He almost lurched at the stick to counteract it, but his training restrained him, and he checked the bubbles in his artificial horizon. They were still aligned. His senses were tricking him. Santen, he said suddenly. What time is it? I'm going to be late for the wedding. He felt panic surface through the swamp of his weakness, and the wings of darkness beat more frantically behind his eyes. I promised her. I swore an oath. He checked his watch. 4:06. That's impossible, he thought wildly. Bloody watch is wrong. He was losing track of reality. The SE-5A burst out of the cloud into one of the holes in the layer. Michael flung up his hand to protect his eyes from the brilliance of the light, and then looked around him. He was on the correct heading for the airfield. He recognized the road and railway line, and the star-shaped field between them. Another 6 minutes flying, he calculated. The sight of the earth had orientated him again. He took a grip on the real world and looked upwards. He saw them there, circling like vultures above the lion kill, waiting for him to emerge from the cloud. They had spotted him. He saw them turn towards him on their rainbow-coloured wings, but he plunged into the cloud on the far side of the opening, and the cold, wet billows enfolded him, hid him from their cruel eyes. "I've got to keep my promise," he mumbled. The loss of contact with the earth confused him. He felt the waves of vertigo wash over him again. He let the SE-5A sink slowly down through the layer of cloud, and once again come out into the light. There was all the familiar countryside below him, the ridges and the battle lines far behind him, the woods and the village and the church spire ahead, so peaceful and idyllic. "Sun tan, I'm coming home," he thought, and a terrible weariness fell over him. Its great weight seemed to smother him and crush him down in the cockpit. He rolled his head and he saw the chateau. Its pink roof was a beacon, drawing him irresistibly. The nose of his aircraft turned towards it, seemingly without his bidding. "Santan," he whispered, "I'm coming. Wait for me. I'm coming." And the darkness drew in upon him, so that it seemed that he was receding into a long tunnel. There was a roaring in his ears, like the sound of surf heard in a seashell, and he concentrated with all his remaining strength, staring down the ever-narrowing tunnel through the darkness, looking for her face, and listening over the sea sounds in his ears for her voice. "Santan, where are you? Oh God, where are you, my love?"